Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Anna Mateo, Jonathan Evans, Alice Bryant, and Phil Dierking. But first, the Higher Education Report, with help from Katie Weaver.
Applying for admission to a college or university in the United States can be a long and difficult process. Even after applicants submit all the required materials to their schools of interest, there is still much to do. Hebe Fuller says what comes next depends greatly on the first steps the applicants took. Fuller is the Director of International Admissions at Elon University, a private liberal arts university in Elon, North Carolina. She spoke to VOA about different ways to seek admission to U.S. schools. Fuller said many American colleges and universities let applicants choose one of three admissions paths. The possible paths are early decision, early action, and regular decision. Usually, all three require the same kinds of application materials, she said.
Most high school students in the U.S. apply to college in the first half or fall of their last year of high school. Fuller said most students should apply to several colleges and universities. But if an applicant knows exactly which school they want to attend, he or she should consider requesting early decision. Schools that offer early decision expect students to complete and submit their applications several months before the regular deadline. The schools also make their decisions about those candidates early. But, Fuller noted, early decision candidates must understand they have entered a binding agreement to attend the school if accepted. Early action is a little different. Students also submit their applications earlier and schools answer earlier. But the student is not bound to attend the school if accepted.
So why do early decision or early action? Fuller said both paths will improve the chance of acceptance. We like to offer admissions to students that will accept our offer, she told VOA. So those that apply early decision have the highest level of acceptance. Early action, we understand that students are applying to multiple schools, but they are also demonstrating more interest. So we don't necessarily pay more attention, but we recognize that they are considering us. Fuller also said that some schools will still consider students for regular decision even if they were rejected from early decision or action. Most American universities inform regular decision candidates of acceptance or rejection in the spring. Then, Fuller said, accepted students must pay a deposit to the school they most want to attend.
The deposit amounts to a small percentage of the cost of the first year of study at the university or college. Fuller said, even at this point, some students still may not be sure about which school they want to attend. Most schools that offer admission give applicants several months to decide to accept or not. So, Fuller suggests applicants visit or revisit the schools to help them decide. Students and their families can also use this time to do more research on the schools, Fuller suggested. They can learn about the community in which the students would live and about the environment. They can also consider how much financial aid each school is offering. However, Fuller said students should not take too long to make their decision. Students who provide deposits might be put on the list for housing at some schools. The earlier the deposit, the higher on the list and possibly the better the housing choices.
Fuller said the university's housing department will ask students who plan to live on campus for information about their personalities. This will help department officials decide which students live together. Students who will not live on campus should use this time to research other housing in the area, Fuller advised. Fuller said the next major step on the path to college is the process of orientation. Orientation is a series of informational events for new students. It starts about a week before classes open. Fuller said orientation can be very helpful, especially for international students.
Sometimes a college or university will not accept or reject an applicant. Instead, closely competitive candidates will be placed on a wait list. This is a safety measure for schools. They know that some applicants to whom they offer admission will decline it. So the school will offer that admission space to a student on the wait list. Waitlist applicants are usually close competitors to those offered admission. When we're looking at the waitlist, we're not necessarily looking at who's number 1, 2, or 3, Fuller explained. It's more of what kind of student will complement the class that we're trying to form.
When it comes to facing total rejection by a given school, Fuller urges students to remember that things do not always go as they expect. That is why they planned ahead and made sure to apply to several schools and keep their choices open. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Pete Musto.
Now, the VOA Learning English program, Words and Their Stories. Each week, we explore the meaning of words and expressions used in everyday American English. People all over the world love sports. Some of us play a sport for fun, some to stay in shape, a few for the love of the game, and even more play to win. If you play to win, you had better have a game plan. A game plan is just like it sounds, a plan to win the game. But we use this expression for just about anything. If a friend says, "Hey, let's take a trip this weekend," you could answer, "Sure, what's the game plan?" If your business is facing competition from another company, you might need to change your game plan to beat them in sales. But now, let's go back to the world of sports. Many English expressions come from how we play sports. For example, We play some sports, such as baseball and football, on a field. We play basketball on a court. And that leads to our next expression, a full court press. Court, in this case, has nothing to do with trials and judges. It is a basketball court. And press does not mean newspapers or the news. In basketball, it means a very forceful effort by one team to take control of the game. In everyday life, press means to put pressure on someone to do something. Of course, this does not work with everyone. With some people, the more you press them, the more they will not do what you ask. For those who do not watch the sport, a basketball team scores by putting the ball through the basket at the opponent's end of the court. Then the team usually runs quickly back to its own end of the court to defend its basket. The players try to keep the other team from scoring. However, in a full court press, a team does not retreat after it scores. Instead, it attacks or pressures its opponent with a very aggressive defense. So, when someone decides to make an extra strong effort to get something done, that person is making a full court press. You can use this expression anywhere. Use it in any situation where you want to meet a goal or solve a problem. For example, we can use it in politics.
The supporters of the Safe Cosmetics Bill launched a full court press to help it pass. Activists, consumer watchdog groups, and women's health organizations used all of their resources to achieve this goal.
We can use it when talking about business.
The clothing company planned a full court press to beat its competitors during the profitable Christmas buying season. They cut prices, planned special in-store events, and gave away prizes to attract more customers.
We can also use it in our personal lives.
When Sally ran into health problems, her friends used a full court press to help her out. Until she felt better, they cooked her meals, cleaned her house, and walked her dogs.
So, if you have a really important problem to solve or project to do, make sure that your game plan involves a full court press. Be aggressive and attack it from all sides. And that's Words and Their Stories. I'm Anna Mateo.
Cross court Stockton, a three, it's there!
The United States has raised concerns with China about its latest missile deployment in the South China Sea. On Wednesday, the U.S. news network CNBC reported China had installed missile systems on three man-made islands in the South China Sea. The report did not name the source, but said the information came from U.S. intelligence. When asked about the report, White House spokeswoman Sarah Sanders said, "We're well aware of China's militarization of the South China Sea. We've raised concerns directly with the Chinese about this, and there will be near-term and long-term consequences." Sanders did not say what the consequences might be. CNBC reported the missiles were moved to the Spratlys within the past 30 days to Fiery Cross, Subi, and Mischief Reefs. The area is about 216 kilometers from the Philippines, well within Manila's exclusive economic zone. The network said the YJ-12B anti-ship cruise missiles permitted China to strike vessels within 295 nautical miles. It said the HQ-9B long-range surface-to-air missiles could target aircraft, drones, and cruise missiles within 160 nautical miles. They would be the first Chinese missile deployments in the Spratlys, where Vietnam, the Philippines, Malaysia, and Brunei also have claims. Last month, U.S. Admiral Philip Davidson said China could use its forward operating bases in the South China Sea to challenge the U.S. regional presence and would easily overwhelm the military forces of any other South China Sea claimants. China's defense ministry did not respond to a request for comment. Its foreign ministry said China has sovereignty over the Spratlys, and the deployments were for national security needs and not aimed at any country. Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Hua Chunying added, "Those who do not intend to be aggressive have no need to be worried or scared." On Friday, a spokesman for the Philippines said, "With our recently developed close relationship and friendship with China, we are confident that those missiles are not directed at us." He added that the country would explore all diplomatic means to address this issue. Australian Foreign Minister Julie Bishop said the report, if accurate, would be a concern, and the actions would go against China's stated desire not to militarize areas under its control. Eric Sayers is an expert with the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. He called the missile deployment a major escalation. He said the U.S. response could be to cancel the invitation for China to join the multinational naval exercises in Hawaii in July. Sayers said, "China sees its participation in the exercise as a sign of its acceptance among the world's maritime powers." I'm Jonathan Evans.
American scientists are using genetic markers to investigate food poisoning cases linked to romaine lettuce. The Associated Press reports that their use of genetic sequencing is completely changing the discovery of bacteria in food. Genetic sequencing is being used to strengthen investigations and, in some cases, find links between what once seemed to be unrelated diseases. The technology also is uncovering once unknown causes of food poisoning. One such example involved apples covered in caramel, a popular treat in the United States. Up to now, scientists have been looking mainly at one bacteria, Listeria. But the search is expanding. By the end of this year, laboratories in all 50 states are expected to also be using genetic sequencing for more common causes of food poisoning. That includes Salmonella and the E. coli bacteria linked to the romaine lettuce outbreak. The new technique is also helping disease scientists identify food contamination even before it causes people to get sick. Lawyer Bill Marler has taken companies to court when their food products sicken people. He said the technique is changing how outbreaks are discovered. Marler said the testing program is still young. He said it is too early to call genetic sequencing a success. But, he said, it may change how and when outbreaks are found. the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC, supports the program. It estimates that 48 million Americans get sick from food poisoning each year, and 3,000 of those people die from such infections. The use of genetic sequencing involves something called whole genome sequencing, which has been used in biology for more than 20 years. A genome is a kind of genetic map. It contains all of the genetic information, or DNA, about an organism. DNA is short for the term deoxyribonucleic acid. The laboratory process identifies most of an organism's DNA. And scientists use computer programs to compare the DNA of test specimens to see if they are the same as the organism and how resistant they are to current medicines. The technique makes the lab's studies faster, less costly, and more automated, said Robert Tox, one of the CDC's leading experts on food poisoning. Plans are to use the technology against several bacteria that cause food poisoning. But to date, all of the tests have involved Listeria. The bacteria causes around 1,600 cases of food poisoning nationwide each year. But it is also a very deadly infection, killing nearly 1 in 5 people who get it. It can take weeks for people to develop signs of the disease. In the past, some patients died by the time health officials began to recognize the problem. For nearly 15 years, from 1983 to 1997, only 5 Listeria outbreaks were identified in the United States. They were relatively large, with an average of 54 cases for each outbreak. That is how it was with other food poisoning outbreaks. Tox said most foodborne outbreaks were found because they happened in one place, like a town with a popular eatery where people became sick. Outbreaks were studied by asking people what they ate before they got sick. Investigators then compared notes to see what patients had in common. But the science took a big step in the 1990s after a major outbreak happened in the Seattle, Washington area. 4 deaths and more than 700 other infections eventually were linked to undercooked hamburgers from a Jack in the Box restaurant. The meat contained the bacteria E. coli. The outbreak led the CDC to develop a program that used a technique called pulsed field gel electrophoresis. With this, investigators could look at a bacteria's DNA in parts. The program helped health officials more easily link cases. But it was not perfect. It was unable to make exact matches and sometimes missed when cases were related. Then came whole genome sequencing. The CDC began using the technique in food poisoning investigations in 2013. I'm Alice Bryant.
Oysters are a favorite of seafood lovers across the United States. Oysters, a kind of shellfish, are native to U.S. waters on both the Atlantic and Pacific coast. Now, more than 20 eateries and other seafood businesses have joined together on a project to help the environment. Their goal is to collect old oyster shells and use them to grow new oysters.
Project organizers say the recycled shells can also act as a filter. They remove dirty particles from the water. Tony Price is with the Shell Recycling Alliance, a program of the Oyster Recovery Partnership. The program collects discarded oyster shells from seafood restaurants. It then uses the shells as homes for baby oysters. Price told VOA that his truck stops at storage areas behind restaurants to collect containers filled with smelly shells. "We do 7 pickups a week, plus events on weekends," he says. "I'd say we're getting somewhere between 500 and even 800 bushels a week." Last year, the program collected 33,400 bushels of shells from restaurants around the Chesapeake Bay area. Every half shell collected becomes a new home for about 10 baby oysters. Oysters have been a popular choice at Mike's Crab House in Riva, Maryland, since 1958. Mike's is one of more than 330 eateries in Maryland, Virginia, and Washington, D.C. that now recycle oyster shells. Tony Piera says he and Mike's other owners joined the program 4 years ago.
"It's a win-win for us. It's a win-win for the environment. Now Oyster Recovery comes here 2 days a week, and they pick them up."
Over the past year, Mike's Crab House has donated a lot of shells to the program. It is one of the top 10 donors, with more than 822 bushels of recycled oyster shells in 2017. Piera says he thinks more people come to his restaurant now because they know he recycles there.
"They know it's good for the environment and the Chesapeake Bay."
The Oyster Recovery Program began in 2010 with 22 restaurants. Karis King works for the partnership. She says the program has been well received and is growing.
"We've continued to grow and expand. From us, you know, basically knocking on doors, trying to get people involved, it's turned into requests every single day. How do we become a part of this program? I'm really excited about the program. I want to do my part."
The program offers assistance to persuade more restaurants to join. In Maryland, restaurant owners can get tax credits based on how many bushels they donate. The group also educates the restaurant workers about the program and why recycling oyster shells is important. After the shells are collected, the next step is to take them to an area where they are cleaned. The shells sit in the open air for about a year so they can dry and have any living tissue die off and break down. Next, high-pressure water is used to clean the shells. This gives them a nice white color. Then, the shells go to the University of Maryland's Center for Environmental Science Horn Point Oyster Hatchery. Stephanie Alexander leads the hatchery. She says her team gets small baby oysters, called spat, ready for their new homes. After attaching the spat to the recycled oyster shells, they are returned to Chesapeake Bay. Here, they will continue to grow and increase the oyster population. Alexander says new generations of oysters are very important for the health of the Chesapeake because they help clean the water. Cleaner water creates a healthier environment for fish, other seafood, and plants. I'm Phil Dierking.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.